Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, believing growth of Florida's economy depends on a diverse and inclusive workforce. The Able Trust works with the business community to include talented Floridians with disabilities as vital team members. More information is at abletrust.org. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capitol Report.
Florida's controversial education bill passed during the last lawmaking session still has opponents and supporters at each other's throats.
The same people who are filing a lawsuit saying the law shouldn't stand are also applying, including Orlando, for funds in that bill that they're filing a lawsuit against.
Also this week, Florida made sweeping changes to its building codes following the destruction of Hurricane Andrew, but now there are concerns the state is trading structural integrity for short-term cost savings.
Someday, somehow, you're going to get these events, and the money you spend now may be pennies on the dollars compared to what it might cost in the future.
We'll also follow the ongoing debate in Hollywood, Florida over the renaming of some streets named after Confederate generals and see what state government is doing to better serve kids from troubled homes. I'm Tom Flanagan. Welcome to Capitol Report. U.S. Education Secretary Betsy DeVos praised Florida's school choice programs during a Tallahassee visit this week. Her arrival comes as school districts across the state prepare to battle with the legislature over a new law they say will further destabilize traditional public school systems. We get more on that story from Lynn Hatter.
DeVos's public schedule took her to two Leon County schools. The first stop, Holy Comforter Episcopal, where she read to a classroom of children.
You'll look up and down streets, look them over with care. About some you will say, I don't choose to go there. With your head full of brains and your shoes full of feet, you're too smart to go down any not-so-good street. And you may not find any you'll want to go down.
Later, the secretary was asked about a new Florida education law steering more local tax dollars to charter schools.
Well, I think Florida has continued to be an innovator in approaching education and meeting the needs of students. So again, I would just say, instead of focusing on buildings and systems, let's focus on what is right for individual students and helping them learn.
DeVos is a proponent of private and charter schools. This year, the state gave its growing charter industry a boost with a new law that requires public school districts to share locally generated building and maintenance funds with them. It's a move industry supporters have pushed for years, but it has also triggered nearly a dozen lawsuits from school districts. The latest comes from Duval County, where Paula Wright is the school board chairwoman.
As watchmen, we are sounding the alarm that perhaps these provisions in House Bill 7069 are not constitutional, and we want to test them and make certain that they are constitutional and that they benefit our constituents.
Other districts suing the state are Bay, Broward, Hamilton, Lee, Miami-Dade, Orange, Palm Beach, Polk, St. Lucie, and Volusia. House Speaker Richard Corcoran spearheaded the legislative effort, and speaking to reporters recently, he called many of the districts now suing hypocrites.
The same people who are filing a lawsuit saying the law shouldn't stand are also applying, including Orlando, for funds in that bill that they're filing a lawsuit against. It's the height of hypocrisy. It's everything that's wrong with government gone wrong.
That's because the law includes funding to help address chronically low-performing schools, and some of the same districts suing have applied for those dollars. The speaker says he's shocked by the lawsuits, but charter lobbyist Chris Moya told WFSU back in May the lawsuits from districts were inevitable.
If they see it as a cost, a loss of revenue, then I can't imagine them not trying to find some way to end up in court.
In the past, public school supporters have had the backing of organizations like the State Teachers Union, the School Boards Association, and the Superintendents Association. But Democratic Senator Bill Monford, who heads the Florida Association of District School Superintendents, says his group will not be signing on.
No, the Florida Association of District School Superintendents, we will not be a part of the suit. That decision will be made by the individual school districts, but our association will not join into the lawsuit.
Neither will the Florida Education Association, the teachers' union. Many districts are also still weighing their options, and a few, such as Leon County Schools, have said they will not be suing over the law. Meanwhile, the districts that are moving forward have hired an out-of-state attorney to handle the litigation. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Lynn Hatter in Tallahassee.
The catastrophe caused in Texas by Hurricane Harvey this week has many in Florida concerned, and that's because several accounts of the Texas disaster have suggested lax development regulation may have contributed to the severity of the situation. This year, Florida lawmakers changed the way the state building codes are updated. There are concerns the new law could weaken the integrity of Florida homes in order to cut construction costs. In the wake of Harvey, Kate Payne reports, those concerns are taking on a new significance.
In 1992, Hurricane Andrew floored South Florida with 165-mile-an-hour winds that flattened houses and killed dozens of people. At the time, the state didn't have a uniform building code to regulate the integrity of Floridians' homes.
As you can probably tell by looking at the color of my hair, I was here when we didn't have a uniform building code in Florida. We had multiple building codes throughout the state.
Mike Huey represents the Florida chapter of the American Institute of Architects. The destruction of the storm spurred lawmakers to reform the codes. Regulations on stronger, missile-proof glass, fortified roofs, reinforced concrete pillars, and even nails followed. After 18 years of keeping a uniform code in place and up to date, Huey doesn't want to see the trend reverse.
We would like to urge you to not throw out the baby and the bathwater and the shower at the same time.
But now some insurance experts and building officials are worried the state is walking back its stringent codes. Alan Douglas heads the Florida Engineering Society.
Our members are worried that over time, the Florida code will move further and further away from the international code, and the effects that that would have, particularly in the areas of public safety and welfare.
During the 2017 session, Florida lawmakers approved a sweeping bill reforming the construction industry. That policy is changing how the state's building codes are updated, among many other things. Before this new law went into effect, Florida adopted the widely recognized international codes, whole cloth, and then removed certain language that's irrelevant to the state. Snow regulations, for instance. But now,
we're flipping the process around, and it allows us to take back a little bit more control of our final product.
Republican Senator Tom Lee of Brandon is a home builder when he's not in the state capitol.
It gives the commission the authority and flexibility to review rather than automatically adopt a code that was developed out of state every 3 years.
Senator Doug Broxson of Pensacola is worried that not using the international codes as a baseline could weaken Florida's regulations.
We have a phenomenal building code in Florida. There's no question about it. But the question is, would we have that code today without the without the dependence on the international code that has...
But St. Cloud Representative Mike LaRosa says the state's construction industry is struggling to keep up with the regulations and passing added costs onto the consumer.
We have a real problem in our state, and the problem is the cost of construction. And the cost of construction continues to rise and continues to rise and continues to rise. And a lot of it is because of the codes that we implement.
But Craig Fugate says added costs and inconvenience don't justify any weakening of the codes. He's the former administrator of FEMA and Florida's Emergency Management Division.
Who is it inconvenient to? The person that's buying the home for the next 30 years that will probably go through at least one, if not more, tropical systems? Or the developer and builder who would like to build it faster and cheaper and not have to continue to upgrade every 3 years.
But when it comes to hurricane preparedness and home fortification, insurance expert Jack Nicholson says Floridians will pay now or pay later. He headed the state's Hurricane Catastrophe Fund for 21 years.
Someday, somehow, you're going to get these events, and the money you spend now may be pennies on the dollars compared to what it might cost in the future. And certainly when you talk about loss of life, the lives that he could save would be well worth it as well.
Nicholson says the next big storm will be the true test for the changes to Florida's building codes. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Kate Payne.
A divided Florida Supreme Court has turned down a request by Attorney General Pam Bondi's office to reconsider a ruling in a high-profile home invasion murder in Orange County. Back in June, the Supreme Court overturned the death sentence of Bestman Okafor, who was found guilty of murdering Alex Zaldivar in an Ocoee home in 2012. Bondi's office requested a rehearing, but the Supreme Court, in a 5-2 decision on Thursday, turned down that request. The one-sentence decision, as is common, did not explain the court's reasons for rejecting the rehearing. In June, the Supreme Court said Okafor should receive a new sentencing proceeding. Justices pointed to a 2016 U.S. Supreme Court ruling in a case known as Hearst versus Florida, and a subsequent Florida Supreme Court ruling. The 2016 U.S. Supreme Court decision found Florida's death penalty sentencing system was unconstitutional because it gave too much authority to judges instead of juries. The subsequent Florida Supreme Court ruling said juries must unanimously agree on critical findings before judges can impose death sentences and must unanimously recommend the death penalty. In Okafor's case, the jury ruled 11-1 to recommend death. Still to come on Capitol Report, this week the city of Hollywood, Florida, tackled the question of whether to change three streets named after Confederate generals.
Our country is hurting, and it's because of issues like these have been denied for so long.
Florida's Child Welfare Agency is looking back at its progress over the last two decades.
You're always going to be challenged to improve, and that's okay. We should be challenged to improve because we don't want any bad outcomes for the kids we serve. But to say that we're still in the same place we were 20 years ago, dead wrong.
And testimony at a Tallahassee hearing on the theft of intellectual property suggests little is safe from Chinese appropriation. Even before last month's demonstration and tragedy in Charlottesville, Virginia, communities around the nation began debating the fate of various memorials to the southern side of the Civil War. The Hollywood City Commission has approved a plan to rename three streets named after Confederate generals. Nick Evans reports it's part of a broader effort reassessing the state's relationship with its history.
Next year, Lauren Book wants the Florida legislature to drop three holidays: Confederate Memorial Day, and the birthdays of Robert E. Lee and Jefferson Davis.
I think that what having a holiday is, or having monuments, is to glorify what something is or was, or to honor or pay homage to it. And I don't think that that is something that is appropriate.
Book is a Senate Democrat from Plantation, still serving out her first term. After a showdown in Charlottesville turned violent as white supremacists clashed with their opponents, lawmakers and ordinary people have been forced to reconsider monuments to the Confederacy. Holidays, statues, plaques, school names, those recognitions take many forms. And in Hollywood, Florida, it's three streets.
For about 20 years now, an issue has been prevalent within the Hollywood community with three street names that are named after Confederate generals.
This is Representative Chevron Jones, a Democrat from nearby West Park. Those streets are named after Robert E. Lee, John Bell Hood, and Nathan Bedford Forrest. Doug Getzlow with Safe Southern Heritage says there are 67 Confederate monuments in the state, and nearly every one of them is at some stage of being removed or altered. He says his group is having to fight those who want to remove the commemorations and some of those who would maintain them.
They really have their own agenda, which is, quite frankly, violence. I mean, they some of these groups, and the David Dukes and the pro-Nazis and the KKK, they're interested in promoting their own interests, which really, ironically, have nothing to do with preservation.
Getzlow contends his defense of Confederate monuments is purely a matter of historical preservation. But critics point out slavery is inextricable from the Confederacy, and they argue racial subjugation is so tightly wound up in its legacy that it's impossible to place Confederate figures on a pedestal without also countenancing that government's racism and oppression. It doesn't hurt those arguments that many monuments went up long after the Civil War, under Jim Crow regimes, or in response to the Civil Rights Movement.
How many speaker cards do we have on this item?
Currently, there's 132 right here, and there are probably more coming from downstairs. I don't know.
It's Wednesday night. Hollywood Mayor Josh Levy and the other six members of the City Commission are taking up the matter of those three streets in front of an overflow crowd. They need a supermajority, 5 votes, to move forward with renaming them.
Our country is hurting, and it's because of issues like these have been denied for so long. And it's time to address them.
Carmela Gardner and many others spoke in favor of changing the street names. But there were also some pushing back. often criticizing an earlier move by the commission, putting the decision in its hands rather than mailing ballots to residents. Here's George Gagne.
You don't know how we would have voted. You thought you knew how we were going to vote, but because you took that away from us, I do not respect this commission. And I think to earn that respect back, you need to do the right thing here.
5 hours later, the question goes back to the commissioners, but they spend another hour bickering over procedure. Commissioner Hernandez even walks out in protest.
We're violating our protocol. We're violating our process.
We're still in the middle of the discussion.
No, there was no discussion. The question has been called. With all due respect, I can't participate. Thank you.
The remaining members put the issue to a vote, and five agreed to change the names. But no one seems satisfied with the original slate of replacements, Louisville, Macon, and Savannah. So the commission is planning yet another meeting, this time to draft a shortlist. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Nick Evans.
Florida's child welfare officials are doing a review of their system and already looking ahead legislatively on the state and national level on what can be done to further help children within the system. Sasha Cordner reports.
This year marked the 20th anniversary of Florida's Child Protection Summit hosted by the State Department of Children and Families. The summit allows for child welfare professionals and other stakeholders to collaborate and exchange best practices that will help address DCF's needs. DCF Secretary Mike Carroll says his agency has made a lot of strides with the state's foster care children.
We are a system that struggles to get it right all the time. But to say that we have not improved at all in the last 20 years is just not right.
That, Carroll says, in the last two decades, the stats don't lie.
We've reduced the number of kids in out-of-home care from 30,000 in 2001 to just over 24,000 in June of last year, June 2017, okay? That's a 20% reduction, and that's including the increase in kids that we've experienced the past 2.5 years. We're still 20% below where we were 16 years ago, and Florida's child population has increased in the last 16 years faster than any other state.
Still, according to DCF's latest annual performance report, the total number of foster kids placed in what's called out-of-home care has been on the rise since June 2013. That's around the time DCF had a number of secretaries, and Carroll has had the job officially for close to 3 years. Meanwhile, the number of child abuse and neglect investigations launched by calls to the Ford Abuse Hotline has grown by 3%. The investigative workload, which has led to high turnover within the agency, has been scrutinized during past legislative sessions, and it's something Carroll says he continues to look into.
The elephant in the room for our frontline staff is workload, okay? And I think leaders in this state, including me, need to make a commitment to providing work-life balance to the folks who do this work, and we have to be able to provide them the tools and time to work with families in a way that produce meaningful, positive outcomes.
Meanwhile, Deputy Secretary David Fairbanks is worried over the renewal of a waiver that allows DCF to receive and allocate federal funding for different child welfare programs. It includes funds for foster care and services to prevent children from going into the foster care system. But the Title IV e-funding waiver is set to expire next year.
Federal law now says no more waivers after October 2019. That's really bad for us, and we need to use our adaptability to deal with it.
A DCF spokesman says the department is working with the federal administration to seek an extension through 2019 for the waiver. But for now, Fairbanks says DCF is reviewing all their options, including if lawmakers may be able to make any changes to state law to provide help in the absence of the waiver.
It's going to be a major focus for us in terms of child welfare in the next session. The point is, we know how to adapt, we know how to adjust, and we got a biggie coming, and we're going to come out well on the other side.
In the meantime, both Fairbanks and Carroll say they continue to try and look at DCF successes, like the 50,000 kids that have been adopted over the past 15 to 16 years. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sasha Cordner.
Corals are in trouble. global warming, and the increase of disease and overfishing are all leading to catastrophic losses on reefs around the world, including Florida. Biologists are trying to figure out ways to help corals survive. And as we hear from member station WLRN's Nancy Klinginger, one project in the Keys aims at saving one species that is at special risk.
On a calm night at Luke Key Reef, teams of divers are entering the water. They're on a hunt for coral babies. Or more accurately, they're looking for the eggs and sperm that they expect pillar corals will be releasing. Corals spawn once a year, and most corals release bundles of both eggs and sperm. But pillar corals have a gender, so each colony only releases either eggs or sperm.
They have to get lucky and find not just another individual out in the water column, but it has to be of the opposite gender.
Karen Neely is leading this project, a kind of Noah's Ark for pillar coral, to make sure the species survives. Neely is a marine biologist who teaches at Florida Keys Community College. She's been studying pillar coral for more than 5 years. In that time, the corals have disappeared from a lot of the Florida reef tract, and about half of the genetic individuals are gone.
We just don't think there's any natural fertilization going on in the wild. We call this species reproductively extinct, at least on the Florida reef tract.
That means
there's a very real possibility of it going regionally extinct without help.
That help comes in the form of teams of divers from the college and other agencies. Neely deploys them to pillar coral sites around Luke Key Reef off the Lower Keys. The divers are stationed underwater, waiting for the corals to start releasing the gametes, eggs, and sperm. Each team is armed with what Neely calls a coral condom. That's a big plastic bag attached with clips to a hard plastic ring.
We've tried lots of different things to try to catch these gametes, everything from syringes to slurp guns. And last year we just had these big plastic bags, and one of my students improved it by creating this hard structure around it that allowed us to collect these gametes even better.
At around 10 o'clock, the divers return to the boat with their bags, which are emptied into buckets. It's not exactly high tech.
This one is, I believe, another egg. Yep, female. More eggs.
All right, let's dump her in here, and then I'm going to start mixing.
They start pouring the water from the different buckets together, right on the boat. The students gather around, using turkey basters to slurp out little fish and other creatures, while also getting their first good look at the future corals.
Yeah, there's a billion eggs in there. Look at that. Oh my God. That's amazing.
For students and former students like Samuel Richardson, it's a chance to take a tangible action to help coral.
Grew up around the ocean, always on a boat my entire life. I always had fish tanks and had coral in them, fish, everything. So coming down here for school, I really was able to get in with that love and get my hands on some coral, and especially restoration.
The college's boat delivers the buckets to Moat Marine Lab on Summerland Key, which has had notable success in growing corals.
They swim around in buckets for a couple days. We check on them under a microscope every once in a while to see how they're doing.
After about 3 days, the larvae start heading for the bottom, what would be the seafloor out in the wild.
So you've got these swimming larvae that are plunging down towards the base looking for a place to settle.
Last year was the first success for the pillar coral in vitro fertilization project. Neely says there were about 100 larvae that settled at the lab. Of those, 5 have survived the year.
They're still small. They're single polyp still, about the size of a pencil eraser, but you know, they represent the future of the species.
Creating new coral babies is the first step. Next is figuring out how to make them grow fast enough that they could be replanted out on the reef, or at least kept alive in the lab to make sure the species survives. I'm Nancy Klinginger in Key West.
You're listening to Capitol Report from Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, a congressional hearing on the theft of American intellectual property by the Chinese took place Wednesday, not in Washington, D.C., but in Tallahassee, Florida. Two House members from Northwest Florida took testimony from two experts and one victim. The House member hosting the hearing was Republican Matt Gaetz from Florida's 1st Congressional District. In his opening remarks, he described one way the Chinese steal intellectual property that's developed in the United States.
The Chinese government is known for using their military's cyber capabilities to hack into private U.S. tech firms. They steal IP and then transfer the technology to state-run companies for profit off of its development.
Gates' colleague from the neighboring 2nd Congressional District, Republican Neil Dunn, said he was also eager to learn how America's intellectual property might be better safeguarded from Chinese purloining.
The Chinese government does not play by the same trade rules as the rest of the world. They literally require our companies to turn over IP in return for access to their markets.
And sometimes the Chinese simply transfer an entire American company lock, stock, and barrel to China. At least that's what Tallahassee's Dean Minardi says happened to his company, Bing Energy, that he claims was seized by a number of former co-workers led by former chairman and CEO Yong Chen, born in China, but now an American citizen.
Orchestrating a bailout deal that would give the Chinese entity control, this group of naturalized United States citizens effectively stole the intellectual property of Bing Energy and handed it to a company Bing could not control.
And the ripoff can even be a single creative expression. Tallahassee State Representative Loran Osley, a Democrat whose day job legal work often involves property rights, told the story of Capital City sculptor Sandy Proctor. One of his most famous pieces is the large statue of Florida Heisman Trophy quarterback Danny Werfel in Gainesville.
Well, Sandy's walking through the aisles of Hobby Lobby, and he sees a miniature of that exact sculpture that he was commissioned to do, made in China, sold for, you know, a couple dollars.
Can anything be done? On the hearing panel was the American Enterprise Institute's Dr. Derek Scissors. He suggested the U.S. government create a blacklist of those Chinese firms that steal technology and intellectual property, and then lock their products out of the American economy until they promise to change their ways, and then keep an eye on them to make sure they do.
We have to gather evidence about who's really responsible. You don't want to punish people who didn't do anything. That doesn't help anyone. The people who are guilty are still going to act. And now the people who were not guilty who got punished are going to say, well, why shouldn't we steal too? You just punished us anyway.
The Heritage Foundation's Dean Cheng also had some ideas at the government level, but he also had some private sector solutions to prevent intellectual property theft.
If you're going to go to China to negotiate business, maybe you shouldn't bring your personal laptop, which includes the prototype files and your email correspondence with your design engineers and all that. And folks laugh when I say this, except I've talked to folks who have done exactly that.
It seems the congressional delegation from Northwest Florida already appreciates the urgency of addressing the Chinese theft of American know-how. The question remains, can they convince their House colleagues? Congressman Dunn thinks they can.
I think we're fortunate to have a great class, 35 new freshman Republicans we work with, and by the way, the Democrats. There's 25, I think, of them, right? So, I mean, and we've worked well with all of that crowd. So that's a huge chunk of the Congress right there that we can get to immediately. Plus, of course, the committees that we sit on.
Dunn and Gates say they plan to start that education campaign on September 5th when the House returns from its summer recess. Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Jim Ash, Sasha Cordner, Nick Evans, Lynn Hatter, Regan McCarthy, and Kate Payne. We also thank our contributing Florida public radio stations. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Follow us on Twitter at FPRCapReport. And join us again next week at this time for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows at fprn.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, dedicated to connecting businesses and workers with disabilities. Businesses are encouraged to recruit, interview, and hire talented and loyal Floridians with disabilities as they seek to broaden their customer base and reach all of Florida's diverse population. Abletrust.org. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.